Today marks the final day of our sermon series, Over Tables. It started out as like, we're going to do this for 4 weeks and then we'll do something else. And here we are 15 weeks later. It just kept developing more and more and more and more. So those of you who haven't been here the whole time, or if like you joined in the midst of it, we started talking about the table of the one, and that's like you and Jesus, right? The foundation for your discipleship, the foundation for your life with God, your one-on-one time with Jesus. And then that moved into the table on the few, and those are the people in your life that you do the one another's with, the pray for one another's, right? Like encourage one another. The people who you leave church and you go, what the heck was Mitch talking about today? I don't really understand what was going on. Like those people, the people that you can truly be vulnerable with and talk about like the struggles that you have in life, who can pray with you, who can encourage you. And then we moved into the many, and that's us, right? Like that's the church. And we talked about what Jesus said church is versus like what church isn't. And we determined that ultimately what has God called the church to be is the house of prayer. And then we find ourselves here in kingdoms. And we talk about us now. We have been equipped on mission to be the hands and feet of Jesus. And so I'll tell you my answer for the darkness and light thing. First off, I grew up, like I had the TV on when I went to sleep all through my adolescence. And then when I moved out of my parents' house and I lived by myself, it was like pitch black. Pitch black and no noise whatsoever. And I loved that for so long. And then Bree and I got married, and Bree insisted that we have to have a sound machine on. And for the first couple of years, it was like kind of annoying. And then afterwards, like now it's like, now when Bree leaves, like if she goes to stay at her mom's or if she's on vacation or something, and I'm in the house by myself, I'll turn off our like bathroom fan and I'll just lay there and I'm like, I can hear everything. Like I can hear squirrels outside plotting like what they're gonna do the next day. You know, I'm like, maybe I get the whole like, I get it now. I get the whole sound machine thing. I kind of like it. My best friend and I went camping in Fredericksburg. Again, we're like an enchanted rock. We're like 20 minutes from the nearest town, and we're going to bed, and he's like, you don't mind if I play a little white noise, do you? I was like, are you kidding me? Like, we come camping to be out in the middle of nowhere, and he's got his phone. I'm like, the whole point in coming camping is to, like, be away from all that stuff. But sure, whatever's going to help you sleep better, buddy. So I have this routine when I get up. I get up pretty much the same time every day, and it's very dark in our room. We have an alarm clock where you can adjust the brightness, and I have it as far down as it'll go before it turns off. And so, like, when I wake up, that provides enough light to where I can get up, I can walk around the bed, I go to the bathroom and brush my teeth, put my deodorant on, and then I go to our closet and I shut the door and turn the light on so I can get dressed. So obviously I turn the light on and I'm a little like, ugh, but I need to be able to see like what shirt I'm picking out, what pants I'm picking out. And then I turn the light off and I walk back into our room, and all of a sudden, I can't see anything. And more often than not, I either trip over our dog, or I kick the bench at the end of our bed, or like I'm trying to go around to my side of the bed to get my headphones and to get my phone, and I'm trying to feel out like, okay, that's the edge of the bed. I'm trying to figure out so that I don't like wake up Brianna. And eventually, I get to the table, and I've like, I knee the table, and it hits the back of the wall. My phone falls on the floor. So now I've got my phone flashlight out looking for my headphones, and I'm like, my intentions were to not disrupt my wife, and I end up waking up everybody in the house trying to like navigate my way through the dark. And the thing is, it's like whether we're going from a position of darkness into the light, or we're going from a position of light into the darkness, we have to allow ourselves to adjust a little bit first, right? Brianna and I went and saw, I don't know if you guys know this, they have Pride and Prejudice back in theaters for its 20th anniversary. It's pretty sweet, okay? So we went and saw Pride and Prejudice, and we came out of the theater, and like opening the main doors outside, I was like, I physically cannot open my eyes because my eyes are so adjusted to the darkness. And I was like, this would be a great opportunity for somebody to rob me right now. Like they would be like, I have a gun. I'd be like, I believe you. I don't know. Like, here, take it. Like somebody should think about that. Or maybe don't. Maybe that's wrong. I don't know. Anyway. But either way, it's like when we go from extreme positions of like in the light or in the dark, it takes a while for our eyes to adjust to things. And we have to allow like the light to adjust, and you have kind of, you know, just a little bit at a time. And that's kind of like, it's in a similar way, it's like when we are exposed to the light of Jesus, it's like when you first understand the truth, it's almost like shocking and blinding to some degree, right? And you kind of have to allow yourself to adjust to it and to move into it and understand what it really means for your life, you know? And so I want to talk about that today as we think about Peter. I think Peter's the perfect example. He gets so much hate in the Bible, but like he was the one who recognized Jesus as the Messiah, and he ended up being one of the foundational, you know, apostles that spread the gospel. So let's look today. We're going to focus and kind of meditate here for a while. John 21, 15 through 17. And actually, I'm going to give a little bit of context before we even jump into that part. So Jesus has been resurrected. He's appeared to the disciples twice already. And they're kind of not sure what's going on at this point. They're like, okay, so like Jesus was supposed to come and like establish his kingdom and overthrow the Roman government, but like then he was crucified and that didn't really match up with what I thought was going to happen. But then he's resurrected now and he's like shown himself to us and we're kind of like, okay, like what now? And so it says the disciples are kind of just sitting around and Peter goes, all right, well, I'm going fishing. Because like, what is Peter doing? Peter's like, I don't know what to do, so I'm just going to do what I know to do, which I know how to fish. So they go out to fish. They're trying to catch fish and they don't catch anything. And then Jesus comes on the shore and he stands there and he's like, hey, dudes, have you caught anything? And they're like, no. And he goes, okay, throw your nets on the other side. They do. And then all of a sudden they catch more fish than they can really bring in. And then as they're standing on the boat, John is like, wait a minute, that's Jesus. Peter, being Peter, throws his shirt back on, jumps off the boat and swims to shore to Jesus. Like Peter is that guy because everybody else is still on the boat and has to like take their time like rowing back to shore. And Peter is already on shore with Jesus. Like Peter's like that friend. You know, he's like, I'm going to run ahead and get everything done first. He's the one who's showing like, look, Jesus, look at me. I'll swim to shore. These guys will wait on the boat. I can't wait to see you, Jesus. I'm just going to jump off and swim to you. Like Peter's that guy. Peter has constantly made himself that guy to Jesus. He's like, let me show you how committed I am to you, Lord. Let me do all these things to you. Yet he denies Christ three times before he's crucified, right? Like Peter is that guy. He's a man of extremes. And so they get to the beach and Jesus is cooking fish, you know, as you do for breakfast. And they all sit down and they start eating. And this is where we pick up in John 21, verse 15. It says, after breakfast, Jesus asked Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, this is important. He doesn't address him as Peter. He addresses him as Simon, son of John, which was his real name. Jesus changed his name to Peter while he was his disciple, but now he's addressing him as his birth name. It's almost like, you know, when you get in trouble with your parents and they call you by your middle name. Like, that's kind of what's going on here. Jesus is like, hey, Simon, son of John, full name. And Simon, or surely Peter's like, yes, you know, mine was always Mitchell Glenn. And I was like, okay, I'm in trouble. Something bad is about to happen to me. He says, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And what he's saying is, do you really love me more than these guys do? Because earlier in the Gospels, Peter claimed that he was the one who loved him more. And so Jesus is asking him, do you love me more than these? And Peter replies, yes, Jesus, you know I love you. And he says, then feed my lambs. Jesus repeated the question, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Yes, Lord, Peter said, you know that I love you. Jesus replies, then take care of my sheep. A third time he asked, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And this time Peter was hurt that Jesus asked the question a third time. He said, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Jesus said, then feed my sheep. What's interesting here is like, again, being a word nerd, it's like sometimes taking like the Greek and everything, sometimes it can get a little finicky. Here, it's extremely important to understand the different usages of words here. The first two times Jesus asks Peter, do you love me? He's asking him agape. Do you actually, like the Greek word agape is like this overwhelming, like full dedication, full commitment, sacrificial type love. Are you willing to love me to the point of like sacrificing everything you have? And Peter responds with philia, a friendly love. And like, we don't have a good equivalent in Spanish, you would say like, it's te quiero versus like te amo, right? Like it's like a friendly love versus like a romantic love. In English, the only equivalent we have is like, do you love them or do you like love them? Like, that's the best equivalent I can give because, like, we just don't have that hierarchy. But in Greek, there's, like, agape is, like, the highest form of love, like, self-sacrificing love. And philia is more of, like, a brotherly love, like a friendship. And so when Jesus is asking him, like, Peter, do you love me sacrificially? Like, you say you love me more than these guys. Like, would you give your life for me? And Peter responds, yeah, Jesus, I love you like a friend. It's not like the perfect context, but like that's basically what Peter's communicating is like, yeah, Jesus, you know I love you like a friend. And then Jesus asks him again, Peter, do you agape love me? And Peter responds, Jesus, you know I love you like a friend. And then the third time Jesus asks him, Jesus changes into the philia and he says, Peter, do you love me like a friend? Do you really love me like a friend? And Peter responds, he was hurt. His feelings are hurt. And he says, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus says, then feed my sheep. Can you see the emotion happening in Peter right now? Can you see, like, Jesus is asking him agape, and he's responding in philia. And then even as Jesus asks him, do you love me as a friend? And Peter is hurt by that question. Do you realize that Peter is probably thinking back? Like, Peter is talking about going into a room with the lights on. Peter is that guy who walked into the room, was blinded by the light, but just started moving around and tripping over the bed. Like, Peter is just like, he starts flipping over the bed. He starts pushing over. He's like, oh, Jesus, you're the Messiah. Let me do everything I can for you. And Peter is just making a wreck of the room because he's just acting without thinking. Before his eyes is fully opened, he's just moving about the room, hurting himself, hurting things around him. And surely in this moment, Peter is thinking to himself, he's thinking back to like when he told, Jesus is telling the disciples, I'm going to go to the cross. And Peter's like, oh, no, Jesus, like, don't say that. And he's like, get behind me, Satan. And Peter's like, wow, okay, I'm Satan now, okay. Or they're in the Garden of Gethsemane and like they're coming to take Jesus. And what does Peter do? He pulls out his sword and he cuts a dude's ear off. And Jesus is like, Peter, chill, like, calm down. And then he's like, Jesus, I love you more than anybody. I will be with you to the day you die. He's like, I tell you the truth, you're going to deny me three times before the rooster crows. And what does Peter do? He's asked by multiple people, and he denies Jesus over and over again. Then the rooster crows, and that guilt hits him. Surely, Peter is reflecting on all of these moments as he's sitting there with Jesus. And when Jesus asks him, do you agape love me? Do you really love me more than these guys? Surely, Peter is thinking back, and he knows the answer. No. I know my actions do not display that. And so what does he do? He downgrades that love that Jesus is communicating, and he says, I mean, I love you like a friend. I can say with conviction that I love you like a friend. It's not perfect love. It's not self-sacrificial love. But I love you as a friend. And then Jesus asks him, do you really love me as a friend? And Peter responds in hurt. He says, God, you know everything. Peter bows out from the conversation. He's saying, like, look, God, like, you know everything. Have you ever felt that way towards somebody? I know, like, with my son, it's like, man, I love my son. But then there are times where he's like, Dad, you want to play with me? And I'm like, not really. Like, not really. Like, I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I don't really want to sit on the floor and play with Paw Patrol toys. I don't. You know, it's like, my wife, I love my wife. And then there are times that I speak to her out of frustration, out of anger, out of pride. And so then if my wife was to come to me and be like, do you really love me? I have to go, I mean, yeah. Yeah. But do my actions speak that? Have you ever felt that with a friend? You say, like, you think, reflect back to the way that you've treated them over the years or the way that you've behaved with them. And if somebody was to ask you point blank, do you really love them based on all this stuff that you've done? Would you not feel that burn of guilt in your heart to know, like, I do love them, but I don't love them in the way that I wish that I did. I do love them, but I know that I don't always allow my behavior to show that. As a matter of fact, I know that my behavior would oftentimes show that I don't love them. And if you use purely my behavior as evidence, maybe it wouldn't look like I love them as much as I say that I do. You feel that tension in your heart of like, no, I love you, and I love you the best I can, and I know that I fail. That's what Peter is communicating to Jesus right here. He says, Lord, you know everything. He's saying, Lord, you know that I love you. You know the depths of my heart. You know that I've done these things and I've disappointed you and I failed you here and there, but Lord, you know what the intentions of my heart are. You know that. And what does Jesus say? He goes, well, stop cutting people's ears off. Start listening to me. No, what Jesus doesn't go into this list of shame recounting Peter's poor resume. What does he say over and over and over again? Feed my sheep. If you love me, show me. If you love me, then feed my sheep. This is Peter's recommissioning. Because surely at this point, Peter has discounted himself. You know, after denying Jesus three times before he's crucified, surely Peter's like, all right, I'm out. Like, I've messed it up too far to be redeemed from this point. Surely I'm done. And Jesus doesn't sit down with him and go, you know, Peter, we had such great plans for you. You had a bright future. We messed it up. No. Jesus said, this is the rock on which I will build my church. Jesus doesn't go, geez, I must have got it wrong. Wrong disciple, I guess. No, Jesus knew what he was about. What is it about Peter that makes him capable of spreading the gospel? He has a humble and contrite heart. Jesus came and called disciples, which, if you look at it, it's funny. None of the disciples were like scribes or scholars. None of them were well-learned people in society. They are like blue-collar dudes. Jesus called like 3 oil well workers, a couple fishermen, like blue-collar dudes. Why? Because they have humble hearts. It's because the Pharisees and the scribes at the time, they had figured out life. The Messiah was standing in their face and they couldn't see it because they were blinded by their own arrogance. But the blue-collar boys, Peter, John, Matthew, they're desperate for Jesus. And that's far more important to Jesus than perfection. He's like, yeah, I know you screwed up, Peter. But what is your heart? Your heart is to love me, to serve me. I do see everything, Peter. And what I see in your heart is love for me. And that's why I'm recommissioning you. Go, feed my sheep. I'm not looking for you to be perfect. I'm looking for you to keep your eyes on me. You fell off the horse. Get up. Let's go. What a beautiful encouragement that is. Let's move forward to verse 18. It says, I tell you the truth, when you were young, you were able to do as you liked. You dressed yourself and went wherever you wanted to go. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and others will dress you and take you where you didn't want to go. Jesus said this to him to let him know by what kind of death he would be glorified. This is Jesus basically telling Peter, like, look, Peter, you're going to die for me. This doubt you have in your heart of whether or not you're going to serve me well, Peter, you're going to die for me. You're going to be crucified for me. And I was reading a commentary by John MacArthur, and John MacArthur is like, surely this was inspiring to Peter. And I was like, really? I don't know. But taking somebody much wiser than myself, taking their position in consideration, think about Peter. Think about all of his actions throughout the Gospels. Peter was he just jumped off a boat and swam to shore. They're like probably 50 yards out. He could have waited 10 minutes. But he's like, no, jumps and swims. Peter's cutting dude's ears off. Jesus gave no command to cut somebody's ear off in the Garden of Gethsemane. Like, totally peaceful, fine. Peter's just like, I'm ready to go. Like, and it was a servant too, also. It wasn't even like one of the main dudes. The servant's probably like, dude, I'm just supposed to be here to deliver a message. What are you cutting my ear off for? You know, Peter is like that guy who's just ready to go. When they're sitting with the disciples, Jesus asks Peter, who do they say I am? Peter's the only one bold enough to say, you're the Messiah. We know that Peter has this bold heart. So maybe, just maybe, by Jesus saying, look, Peter, that commitment that you doubt in your heart, it's there. You're going to die for me, Peter. You're going to be such a threat to this world for the sake of the gospel that you will be put to death. The enemy knows that you're such a threat to the good news being spread that he will want you to die. That's how committed you are, and that's a warrior that you are for the gospel. Surely that would be inspiring to a man like Peter. Surely Peter's like, heck yeah, dude. Molon Labe, let's do this thing. Anybody get the Greek reference? No? Okay. Peter is like ready to die at this point for Jesus. And Jesus is just rekindling that passion in him. Like, you are going to be that guy. You are that guy. I called you for a purpose. Going back to verse 20. Jesus says, follow me. And then Peter turned around and saw behind him the disciple Jesus loved. This is a really funny way. This is John talking about himself. Throughout the Gospel of John, John refers to himself as the disciple that Jesus loved. Kind of like, okay, John, we get it. So he's saying, Peter turned around and he saw John sitting there. And he said, what about him? Like, you just asked me to follow you. What about John? And Jesus replied, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is it to you? As for you, follow me. What Jesus is saying is like, hey, no. Again. It's like Peter's like rekindled this like passion for God. And he's like, all right, I'll follow you. And 2 steps later, he turns around and goes, yeah, but what about him? All of a sudden, he's lost focus again. Peter probably had ADHD. Probably. And he's going, what about John? Like, you asked me to follow you and go to death for you, but what about John? And Jesus is like, I'm not talking to John right now. I'm talking to you. I have a plan for you. And the plan that I have for you is not the plan I have for John. What is it to you? Do you know better than me, Peter? God has given each person in this room a unique gifting, ability, talent, life experience, including your traumas and your failures, that makes you uniquely able to minister to people around you. Uniquely able. They're just, I mean, you don't understand like the impact of culture. When Bree and I were trying to buy a house, we met this lady who was from Boston. And let me tell you, she rubbed me the wrong way. And it was over something super silly. But she made a comment, and I told Bree, like, this lady talked to me. Didn't faze Bree at all. It's just that northerner thing. You know, they just don't have manners, I guess. And as I was sitting there and I spoke with her, I was like, okay, she wasn't really being rude. It was just kind of like, it was a different impact of culture, right? And certain people are uniquely gifted to speak into other cultures, into other societies, and other people brought up in different areas. Like, again, it's like, I grew up with like guns out in the woods, riding four-wheelers and stuff, so I can uniquely relate to people like that. First time Bree shot a gun was when she was like 24 years old. And it was just the craziest thing to her, you know? This is kind of a side note, but when I was in Australia, me and my buddy Trey, he's from Ohio, I'm from Georgia, we were in the room with a guy from Australia, we're laying down in bed, and we hear a shotgun go off. And we're in the city, we hear a boom, me and Trey don't flinch. We're just like, we're trying to go to sleep. The dude from Australia gets up and goes, did you guys hear that? Me and Trey are like, yeah, it sounded like a shotgun. He's like, shotguns are illegal in Australia, you're not supposed, like, nobody's supposed to have a shotgun. And we're like, oh yeah, I guess you're right, we should be concerned right now, like, a crime is being committed somewhere, you know. But it was just like, just in us. Like, we was like, yeah, shotgun goes off, whatever. Every house I've lived in my life, there's somebody who lives, you know, how many yards away shooting animals and stuff. So it's like, whatever, I don't care. But that's just a unique experience that I have. We all have different experiences and lives that we've lived that make you uniquely equipped to preach the gospel. But don't look at your neighbor and go, how come they have this opportunity and I don't? Why do they have that and I don't? Jesus is like, hey, you've got work to do. It's like when I was in school and kids would look over at other kids' work and they're like, well, look at what they're doing. I'm like, you've got stuff to do. He's not worrying about what they're doing. Their grade doesn't affect you. Let's focus on what you have to do. God has given us an assignment individually that he's called us to. Don't lose sight. Don't lose focus of your mission. Our mission is to make disciples of the nation, but he's uniquely equipped you to be a warrior in that. And so how do we provide light in the darkness for people? Gently. When I was a teenager, I had a futon, and it was like in the middle of my room, which was a unique layout. But the futon was like metal bars, and so the bed would kind of like easily slide one way or the other. And the way my father would wake me up, he would gently open my door. He would come sit on the edge of my bed, and he would rub my back, and he would go, wake up, little Mitchell, wake up. Wake up, little Susie. Like, he would just make his own lyrics up. And he would rub my back, and like, I would probably like wake up, but like, I wouldn't be conscious yet, you know? So I'm just like, okay, Dad. And he would go away, and he'd come back a little later. He'd go, hey, buddy, hey, we gotta get up for school. You gotta take a shower, gotta eat some breakfast, gonna have some fun, you're gonna go learn some stuff. And I'm like, okay. So I start like getting up a little bit slowly. He may even come in a third time, and he's like, hey, buddy, hey, seriously, I have to drive you to school, so like, I need you to get up, buddy, okay? So my dad was like extremely gentle in the way that he woke me up. My mom, first off, there was always the claim that like, this is the fourth time I've been in here, and I was like, I haven't seen you since last night. What are you talking about? But my mom would come in my room, kick my mattress, and it would slide off of my bed onto the floor and fold me over like a little taco. Joke's on her, it was actually pretty comfortable. So I would just stay there. So I would just slide, boom, and it would just close me up. And so I would just be like, whatever, I'm good. And then she started like pulling the blankets off of me, and she's like, go take a shower. So I'd go lay in the shower and fall back asleep in the shower. You know, it's like when you have the gentle inspires, the gentle encourages, right? The rough, the abrasive, the bold. It did not inspire me to get up. I was just like, no, I don't want to. She'd flick the lights on and everything. My dad never would turn the lights on. He was always gentle. And so that's how we are to be on mission for Jesus. We're not looking to be like flashlights in people's eyes, right? Our lives are supposed to be testimony, right? That gentleness of like, we want people to see the love of Christ in us, not be shouted in the face. Not shine in the eyes like a flashlight. I thought about bringing a flashlight and doing that to y'all, but I was like, I don't want them to be super mad at me.
We're supposed to be gentle. And the other thing is, once, you know, in the mornings, once my eyes adjust to the light, I can see pretty well. And you can ask Bree. I treat our house like a cave. Like, if Bree's not home, I keep the lights off. And I don't know if that's just, like, maybe some inherent dad energy in me. Like, why are the lights on? I'm gonna turn the lights off. I don't know. I just like having the lights off. Like, I'm like, the window's letting enough light. I don't need anything. But Bree will come in, and Bree starts turning lights on. She's like, it's like a cave in here. Like, turn the lights on so you can see. Me and Hezzy are just chilling on the couch, just in the dark, you know? I don't know. That was just funny. It kind of bridges my next illustration, but whatever. The point is, like, once we have our eyes adjusted to the light, and we can navigate and see, it would be ridiculous for us to have somebody come in that room whose eyes are not adjusted, and they start knocking into things, or they're groping on the ground, and for us to just stand there and look at them and be like, look at this idiot. They can't see anything. That's how, when we treat people who are not believers like they're groping around in the dark and like they're stupid, that doesn't inspire them to open their eyes to see the light. Rather than staring at them, watch them groping around in the dark and go, you just don't get it. Walk over to them and lead them to the light. Help them to see where the obstacles are. Help them to be led into a place where they can see, right? Standing on signs, holding pickets is not a way to help them see the light. Loving them, like meeting them where they're at, because that's the thing, there's no depth. Is there any sin greater than that can be covered by the blood of Jesus? The answer is no, by the way. So if there's people in your life who you're like, wow, they're like so far gone. They're too far gone. No, they're not. There's no depth that they could crawl to that would separate them from the love of Jesus. None. So we can't look at people and say, ah, they're too far gone. No, they're not. It might take them a little more work to get back to the door. They might be deep into the room to where they need a little bit more guidance to avoid some obstacles to get back to the light, but they're not too far gone. They're not too far gone to be saved. But we can't just look at them groping around on the ground and be like, wow, I wish somebody would do something about that. We do something about that. We have to be the light to the world. As we close, it's appropriate to look at Peter's letter, his first epistle in chapter 2, verse 9. It says, yes, you who trust him recognize the honor God has given him. But for those who reject him, the stone that the builders rejected has now become the cornerstone, and he is the stone that makes people stumble, the rock that makes them fall. They stumble because they do not obey God's word, and so they meet the fate that was planned for them. But you are not like that, for you are a chosen people, you a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's very own possession. As a result, you can show others the goodness of God, for he called you out of darkness and into his wonderful light. We are called to be a light unto the world, right? Not a flashlight in the ice. We have to let our good deeds be visible. We're not asking you to show off. It's not showing off, but it's encouraging you for our lives to be examples to people. It's like nobody knows how much you, or what is the phrase? Nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. It's like my students in school. You would watch them with another teacher, just hit them with truth all day long. But then, like, they would be mean. And then, like, they wouldn't really care about their life. It's just like they're just hitting them with truth. Well, truth just bounces off if I don't know how much you care about me. But when you build a relationship with somebody and then you go, hey, you've missed it here. That stings, right? It says, what is it, faithful are the wounds of a friend? It's like, when I know that you care about me and you're willing to correct me, that hits differently. And so in order to have that impact on somebody, we have to invest in their life enough and care about them enough to where those words can correct them. Because if you just go up to the next person you see who doesn't love Jesus and you go, you're doing it wrong. They're like, another hypocritical Christian who just like yelled at their waiter in Chili's. We have to let our lives be an example. That's what this whole series of tables is being about. It's like, there's not tiers. It's not like, oh, I'm at the one, and then I'm at the few, and then I'm at the many, and now I can go do a mission. No, it's all together. It's all together. We have to continuously be attached to Jesus and with our eyes on Jesus in order to then exist in healthy community, in healthy church, to be on mission healthily for people and for the kingdom. We have a mission, and we have to choose to fulfill it by example. Amen?